introduction of our speaker. Okay. Reverend Barry Whittemore is a retired Unitarian Universalist minister, having served at the Georgia Baptist UU Church in Dahlonega. Reverend Whittemore has also served congregations in Birmingham, Alabama, Outlaws Bridge Universalist Church in North Carolina, and Holston Valley UUC in Tennessee. Dr. Whittemore has 27 years of teaching experience, ranging from community college seminars to the Mountain School for the Congressional Leadership. Oh, goodness. He holds a bachelor's degree from Virginia Tech, master's degrees from Radford University and from Carnegie Mellon. He earned his doctorate at Carnegie Mellon and a Master of Divinity from Duke University. Dr. Whittemore currently teaches Appalachian American and Religious History at UNG. His greatest pleasure comes from traditional Southern Mountain old-time music and dance. Please join me in welcoming Reverend Barry Whittemore, coming home to Universalism. You move my barriers. I think it's safe now. Okay.
I can do this in 10 minutes. There was a time when I'd been downsized from my first full-time teaching job, and I was living with my dad down in Norfolk. It was a lot of fun for 3 or 4 months. I was there for a year. But one thing I would do, I would go on a walk every day. It was part of my routine. And I'd do it in the middle of the afternoon, which some people thought was crazy. This was in Norfolk, Virginia. I said, well, it's hot then. Yeah, but I'm good in the morning and I'm good in the afternoon, but frequently, or at night, but in the afternoon I kind of dull out. So I was out walking one day, just kind of bopping along, and I was going down the street. School had just let out, and there was this young fellow, a couple hundred feet in front of me, walking along, his school books in one hand and a soda in the other, drinking soda and walking along. And he finished the soda, and he took it in this sort of middle-class neighborhood, and just flipped it up into a yard. I thought, well, obviously he doesn't live around here. He'd never do something like that. 2 houses later, he turned in. And it struck me, it's like, where is our sense of community? And what has happened to it? As a historian, I see this just as another symptom of the conflict between the Hamiltonian view and the Jeffersonian view, which some of you have heard. And this whole loss of community affects a lot of things. I mean, would we litter in our own community? Would we not take better care of the environment? Our physical space. This is where we live. Well, years later, I went into ministry, and when I went to my first church on, this is great, we're going to do social justice and we're going to do all this great stuff here. And after a while, I realized that almost everybody coming to the Holston Valley Unitarian Universalist Church was coming there for community. They didn't know it, but there's this inherent, unarticulated need to belong to a community. Something that everybody knew a couple hundred years ago, but we have forgotten. It's just simple. I mean, nowadays, a lot of us, you know, our parents move while we're growing up, and then we go off to college somewhere else, and then we go to another place when we get our first job, and then we get promoted and go somewhere else, and so we move and move and move and start losing track. And I wonder, how did we get this way? Is it politics? Democracy versus rule of the elite? Is that what the problem is? Is it economics, belief in the commonwealth as opposed to capitalism? Is it society? Is it the difference between traditional values and modern values? Or is it religion? Because in the old days, everybody believed in predestination. And now we're all about free will. So who's in charge? Who makes the ultimate decisions, especially if we start thinking about eternal souls and that kind of stuff that a lot of people concern themselves with? In the West, we figured this out over a millennia ago. It's a settled question. We can go back all the way to the early 400s when you had the controversy between Pelagius, who was this British monk who had been off to the desert with the desert fathers, and on his way back to Britain from Egypt, he stopped in Rome for a while and he thought, well, these people are kind of messed up here. What's wrong with the church in Rome? And he goes, I think I figured out what it is. He had several reasons, but he thought it was the idea of predestination. Well, these people think, you know, it's already decided, so they don't have to work at it. So maybe it's free will. And this so freaked out the local bishop, Augustine, that he spent the rest of his career writing to counter Pelagius. And gets to be a saint for it. But then, you know, and Augustine wins the argument. You know, that becomes the doctrine of the church. Even when the Protestant Reformation comes along, one of the two main guys, Calvin, he's all about predestination. This is how it's decided. But then, when we get to the 1600s, we start to see a different controversy come along. It starts in the 1600s. The Dutch Reformed Church, which is Calvinist, had heard there was a group of people there who were meeting somewhere that believed in free will. So they sent Jacob Arminius, one of their main clerics, to go check them out, spy on these people, figure out what's going on. And Arminius goes, and he listens to them, and he goes, you know, I think they're right. And he writes about the doctrine of free will, which is now sometimes in religious circles called Arminianism, after him. So it keeps on boiling like that, and especially in the United States. Around the start of the 19th century, around 1800, we have what's called the Second Great Awakening. The Second Great Awakening was really very specific in that there was a single issue, because we were moving from the old predestination to the doctrine of free will. It was all about evangelizing. Of course, evangelizing meant a different thing 200 years ago than it does now. So it's this conflict, you know. With the Baptists, they split over the idea of missions. Because if you believe in predestination, what would be the point of having missionaries? Because God's already decided that. So who do you think you are to go out and try to win souls? It would make no sense. So they split over it. But this is happening at the same time as the Industrial Revolution in this country. And we see our culture changing. Our politics, our economics, all of society changes during the Industrial Revolution, which is happening at the same time as the Second Great Awakening. And what we see is the center of our spiritual universe changes. No longer is God in the center of our spiritual universe. The spiritual universe, the spiritual center of the universe is, well, me. Because I get to decide. It's all about my decisions. It has nothing to do with that God person. And we start seeing the start of a long decline in America. We stop thinking about commonwealth and start thinking about personal wealth. We see the commodification of labor. No longer does the shoemaker go in and make a pair of shoes for an individual. You've got a job on an assembly line and you sell your time. And it just becomes a commodity like anything else to be traded and sold. We see the commodification of nature. That's not a beautiful wooded mountainside. That's X number of board feet of lumber that we can cut down, clear cut it, and then maybe build a Bavarian village to get the tourists to come up to it. Why do you think Helen's there? They had cut down all that land, all the timber. They had cleared it off. They already had a railroad out there. They go, how can we still make some more money off this land after we've cut every tree on the mountain down? Well, let's build a Bavarian village and get tourists up from Georgia, or from Atlanta. We see our community start to shrink. It's not where everybody in town knows who you are, or even everybody in your neighborhood knows who you are. we get to the point now where a lot of us don't know our next door neighbors. So our communities, our sense of community shrinks. Our families shrink. Now we're all about, you know, the nuclear family. We're just the real small family. We're not talking about aunts and uncles and great uncles and great grandparents and four generations in one household. So that all seems to shrink. And there's the multiple mobilities, educational mobility, geographic mobility, economic mobility. And with this actually comes a lot of great personal opportunity. I can go to school, I can move away, I can go somewhere and get a job, I can do all this great things that'll be good about me. I can take care of myself even better. So it becomes more and more all about me, even in religion, where God is now going to be a bit player and is perhaps even a superfluous extra in the scene. What has it got us? When was the last time a politician called you a citizen? They call you taxpayers. What's the difference between a citizen and a taxpayer? A citizen is the part of a large community. Yes, and it's still, if you don't pay, you're going to go to jail, but it's my money. When they appeal to taxpayers, they're appealing to the greed in individuals. I remember a long time ago, I lived in a rural county in Virginia, and they were putting up a bond issue for the school system. High school needed a new roof. There's some other things they needed done. And some guy, I can't believe he let himself be quoted on the front page of the paper. He was all in arms. Why should I have to pay more taxes for the schools? My children have already graduated. Because it's all about me and mine. So if nobody else has schools to go to, that's okay because I already got mine. And had no compunction about having his name on the front page saying that. Because it just seemed normal because, by God, he was a taxpayer. Not a citizen of the county or a citizen of the town who wanted what was good for the community. And we even choose churches like that. We choose churches like we choose political parties. Well, I'm going to go look for a church, and I'm going to look until I find one that suits me. I'm not going to conform to anybody else's ideas. They have to come to me. If it's not all about me, I don't want to be part of it. What we're doing, basically, is worshiping the golden calf of individualism. While the world dissolves around us, how good's our world doing? What do you think about the executive branch, state or national, and our legislature? I remember when the U.S. Senate was the greatest deliberative body in the world. But if nothing else, when I was young, the polls showed that the most respected position in the United States was a Supreme Court justice. So how's things going? How's our economy going? How many people are worried about the economy, the common good? Yeah, the stock market's doing great. The stock market is not the economy, and the economy is not the stock market. There's some good stuff going on there, but it's not reaching a lot of people. And there's those old things, dress codes, manners, common decency. When I was at my first church, one of the differences between Unitarians and Universalists, when I was in a Universalist church and they had a potluck, when everything was set out, they would stop, find the minister, have them give a blessing, and the minister go first through the line. At the first Unitarian church I served at, while I was greeting people going out the door, they had already started the line, and sometimes there was not a lot of food left by the time I got there. And I was there going through the line once, and there was one of the women of the church excoriating her teenage son because he was drinking soda from a 2-liter bottle. And she said, "Just no class at all. You know, this is not the way to do it. This is improper behavior, and you shouldn't do that." Poker face. He was wearing a tank top and soccer shorts. So it's okay for your kid to go to church in a tank top and soccer shorts, but not drink out of a 2-liter bottle. How's he supposed to figure that out? I'll bet a lot of people in this room, when you were a child, had three kinds of clothes. You had play clothes, you had school clothes, you had church clothes, and your behavior conformed to what you were wearing, and vice versa. You just acted differently because you didn't dress the same way all the time and you didn't act the same way all the time. Anybody been to a movie recently? There's a lot of people used to watching things on the VCR and they'll treat the movie theater like their living room. Check the phone, have conversations, not worry about all those other people. And manners, a lot of people in my generation like to dismiss manners for a while. Manners are just formalized civilization. What are manners anyway? It's showing respect for other people. That's all good manners is. The fundamentals of civilization. If we don't have that, we don't have anything. And I really just wonder sometimes where common decency has gone to. Destruction of the built environment. In Dahlonega, they're getting ready to tear down two of the oldest buildings in town so the richest person in town can build a hotel. And we'll probably destroy the character of the town. Shoot the whole planet, you know. Things are going bad. Of course, it's always 90 degrees in November, isn't it? Or October. Yes, I've never experienced 90 degree weather in October. But as long as I get mine now, it's okay. Yeah. I believe in being a good steward, and the world's going to end soon, so anything we haven't used by then is going to be wasted. And besides that, once I'm dead, who cares? Because it's all about me. So do we see the rise of the doctrine of free will and the death of civilization? You guys are starting to worry now, aren't you? But wait. I'm a universalist. And it is part of our heritage, half of our heritage, though we don't get to talk about it much. It's true, I was born and raised a Southern Baptist, which is very free will. I mean, they're all about free will. Then I ditched that, became an atheist. Then I figured out the atheists were more dogmatic than the Southern Baptists were. So I went for agnostic, which is probably the norm for most people. We don't know. Actually, I had one of my mentors when I was in school. I kind of worried. I said, you know, I'm really kind of an agnostic. And he said, well, Barry, it's the only intellectually honest position you can take. Because none of us know for sure. We have our suspicions. We don't necessarily know for sure. And then I chose to be a UU. At first, I was a Unitarian. I was going to the First Unitarian Church of Pittsburgh. And I always wondered why those little parentheses at the bottom of the sign that said Unitarian Universalist, what the heck that was about. It took me a couple of years to find out. And they were all about free will. You know, it's moral self-culture. It's the development of your own character. Salvation by character. But as I learned more, I gradually migrated to the Universalists, feeling much more comfortable there. And there really were theological differences between the Unitarians and the Universalists at the time of merger. We just never had a conversation about it. We talked about structure and who got what money and some political stuff, but we never talked about theology at the merger of two churches, which is strikes me kind of odd these days. We talk about being dogma free and we're not theological, so each person gets to choose, which kind of makes us godlike. Which now, if you read our own literature, both of them say that the Unitarians and the Universalists were anti-Calvinists. Not really. The Unitarians were clearly anti-Calvinist. The Universalists of that time would have never accepted that label. They had a different way of putting it themselves. We believe in Calvinism improved. Because think about it, universal salvation means everybody's going to heaven whether they want to or not. So, is there free will in the afterlife? Well, by the Universalists, no, there's not. So they're not Calvinists, they're Calvinists improved. It's just, we're all going to the same place. It's not two or three different locations. We're all going to be there together. And since we're all going to be there together for freaking eternity, why can't we just get along? Because we're all in this together. We're all human beings. We all live on one planet. We're just one giant community. And we're going to be together forever, so let's get started. I like that a lot better. And I think that's a really important belief. So this old style of universalism, the elect was everybody. And as a result of that, they were an incredibly egalitarian group of people. Nobody's better than anybody else. We all came from the same place. We're all going the same place. And so don't get your back up. Don't get all full of yourself. And they were communal to the core. These are really important values, I think. The values of old-time universalism. And I tell people now, if I could find a 19th century universalist church, I would go there every Sunday. But they're hard to come by. So, the idea that everybody's eventually going to the same place, they had their divisions. Because just think about it for a second. You have people like Ballou out there, and he's using his rational mind and saying, well, everybody must go to heaven immediately after their death. Because if there's not, then they're taking sin into the afterlife. The afterlife is perfect, therefore there could be no sin. So he was what they called the death and glory school. You pay for all your sins before you die. And then there's a lot of us who are a little more human than that. I know people that I don't think have paid for all their sins in this life. And I don't think they're going to make it right away. So they were called the final restorationists. They had the idea that there would be a period of time, and one guy even figured it out, maximum sentence, 50,000 years. Well, 50,000 years divided by infinity is how long? Yeah. It's the last time you had a bad paper cut. So it's you know, how you deal with that. But the idea for all of them was that eventually everybody would be there and we would be together. And it'd be like, you know, what we've got only better. The closeness to the divinity. So it's kind of a funny thing for a former Southern Baptist who spent years as a Unitarian Universalist minister to reflect on the joys of Calvinism. Maybe there's something to that. I am a traditionalist. I've become that. Not because I've gotten older, but I think I just read too much history. So, you know, the good thing about being a conservative is you try to hold on to what is good. The bad problem with being a conservative is you can become ossified. You become like a living fossil and you can't bend and can't change. The good thing about being a liberal is your openness, your willingness to look at different questions and consider different ideas. The downside is you can be open-minded at both ends and stuff just kind of goes straight through and you say, we're just going to chuck everything that's old and any fad that comes along, I'll just jump on it. So is one bad and one good? Not necessarily. A judicious mixture of the two. You know, to be open-minded, but also be mindful of the good things that we have and not just throw them away right away. You know, there's some good stuff about the old ways of doing things. I have to deal this with my students every year. They're not allowed to have any electronic devices in my basic courses, including laptops. You will learn to write by hand. They think it's because I'm a fuddy-duddy. But a few years ago, it was the big thing, we put a laptop in every room, they're all going to be smart. Well, rich people get education, poor people get technology. We now have the data that says, if you take notes by hand, you retain more, you learn more, and it's easier to study. So there's reasons for doing things the old way, because they work. Some things don't. So it's just judging, what do we check out? What do we keep? And I have to keep asking myself, I think I did this fairly early on in my ministry, much to my own surprise, when I realized, Barry, you're not in charge of anything. So don't think that you have all the answers. If you think you have all the answers, all you're going to do is drive people crazy, especially yourself. So, I don't know the answer for sure, but I think there's something more to it than what I know, and I'm willing to listen to the old ways to see what I can learn from them before I go rushing off pell-mell into the future. Yeah. Thank you. That's all. All right.
Anyone have any questions?
When you talked about it in the very beginning, I would call this the atomization of society.
Yep.
I think a very big contributor of that has been the automobile and then the suburbs, which is the epitome of the me person, where it's all about the house and the buying and, you know, just that whole thing. And I think the movement back to small towns, people who realize it's a better lifestyle, it's a move in the right direction. And the second thing, you hit upon one of my pet peeves. I call my cell phone F1. You know what F stands for. When I left my house and forgot my phone upstairs, I had to go get it. Yeah. And to me, and the way people use cell phones, and there's no more socialization at meals, I think it's one of the worst things that ever came developed in society. Yeah. Although it has its use.
Yeah. Well, yeah, when I go into a classroom and there are, you know, 30 or 40 single, attractive 18-year-olds sitting there, and none of them are talking to each other. But besides, I won't put it all on the automobile. Chuck in with that lump, air conditioning and television. I was just visiting with a friend of mine who was raised in Atlanta. The houses were built right next to the street. Everybody had big porches, and you sat on the porch, and people went up and down, and you talked. Somebody comes down, you invite them in for some tea or something like that. We move to the suburbs, we move the houses back. There's a little stoop or maybe a decorative porch, and there's a deck out back in the fenced yard. We just shift it. You know, you go by down the street at night, and you see that blue glow coming from behind the closed windows. Sam, it's how we use things. The technology is an evil, but it enables us to become lazy. It's real easy to just turn inward. Talking to people is hard. It's easier for me to stand up here and talk to you guys than it will be 15 minutes from now when I'm standing out there if I want to approach somebody I've never talked to before.
Can you explain predestination to me? And do any churches still believe in that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Lots of them. They're most simply is that God decided before the beginning of time who was going to be saved and who was not going to be saved. It was your destiny was preordained sort of preordination, predestination. And there's a bit of a logic to it. And it's the logic that it took me 40-some years to get this one. And it took a weird kind of personal experience. Okay, according to most people, you know, how much power does God have? All powerful. Okay. So how much left over for you? None. If God knows everything that has happened, is happening, and will happen, how much choice do you have? I mean, if you get the really hardcore predestinarians, they know. Or they can say, well, God knew from before the beginning of time that you would wear a blue top to church because it was all predestined. Now, some people say, you know, that they're, you know, everything that happens is predestination. Like the old joke about the Presbyterian lady that falls down the stairs and gets up and dusts herself off. Well, I'm glad that's over. And other people say it's just your ultimate destination. It's just where, who's going to heaven, who's going to hell, who's a member of the elect to go, and who's not a member of the elect and ain't going. Beats me. That's the reason I'm a universalist and not, you know, one of those, that type of predestinarian. But there are plenty of people who still believe that. And I mean, sure, you haven't been up in the mountains enough. There are still primitive Baptists. The Presbyterian church is split over that. I mean, the church I'll go to usually when I have a chance is a Presbyterian church, and it's way liberal. It's way liberal. The guy's a universalist. I mean, I heard the first two sermons and I went, you sound like a universalist. He goes, yeah. He makes no bones about it. They're so liberal that in White County, they're called the Lesbyterians. Yeah. Everybody thinks they do.
Yes. We can't hear you over here.
You can't hear me.
No. Lots of space in between there.
So,
one thing, that there is a vast area between there is no God and God has figured out everything. One of the more interesting developments in theology in the last half century has been process theology. And kind of the 25 words or less version of that is, who says creation is done? That it's an ongoing process. And if it's an ongoing process and we are put into it, then we become part of it. So we're creating, we're still creating. You know, we're not done yet. We're still, because there's obviously change, there's evolution and all that stuff. So there's that going on. That's one version of it. And then there's the old, in the mitzvah, or not mitzvah, in the midrash, they're the old Jews who say, well, God created humans because he likes a good story. They were just stories that we kind of make them up. That's kind of an interesting look at it. But why would God, you know, maybe, you know, creates us in its image and then lets us go? The deists all believe that, you know, the clockmaker God, God creates the universe, creates all these people, and like a big clock, he winds it up, sets it on the table, and takes his hands off. So that means it's all up to us now. That's the hard part about it. That's what a lot of people don't like about it. It's because now, who's responsible for the earth and how we are? We can no longer say, well, it's God's fault. Now it's our fault. And we have to take responsibility.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
I really don't think you can blame everything on free will, because I believe strongly in free will, but I also believe in community. And I think you can have these Calvinists that were pretty ugly and mean and rotten, just as much as you can have Joe Blow, who's not a Calvinist.
Yeah. It's not necessarily one or the other, but one of the things we're told as we go into ministry, if we have anybody that's good at advising us, is we have two jobs. One is to comfort the afflicted. The other is to afflict the comfortable. So I'm just afflicting you guys a little bit today.
One of the ideas that you come across is this idea that we have a confused God. But we have confused this idea of our own concept of time and our own existence in time with the idea that God exists in time, and that perhaps he does not at all, and so that the entirety of our creation, our existence, the earth, the universe, and all has happened already in one instant in the mind of God, if indeed he does exist.
Yeah.
Or she. Right. And so, or even whether God
can't if you're God. You can if you're God. We're just humans.
You kind of go along with that. There's
a little bit. Or which new thought? Oh, okay. That's a new thought.
Yes. Well, it's
I know more of the old new thought.
Okay.
New thoughts come along every couple generations. Yeah. Oh, it's me in charge. I create reality.
Well, everybody.
Yeah. There could be problems with that because if we're all creating different realities, how many realities are there? Yeah. Some of us think there might just be one.
I volunteer at the Ellis Science Museum a couple, 2-3 times a month. Yeah. I went to the educators training. There are people who are paid. Groups come through. I'm just an explainer. I'm sort of a volunteer who helps out. But what struck me after that training, going through some of the different parts of the museum, is if you think astronomically, we are a speck. And I think we need to be just humble.
Yep.
That's the message that I want to bring.
Yeah. Well, maybe... in an odd moment, I thought, well, maybe, you know, the Big Bang was a sneeze. God sneezed, and what we think of as the universe is just a sort of little glob of snot going through space. It just takes a long time. I mean, we don't know. We don't know. We're very agnostic about that. But it strikes me when you read or talk to cosmologists, they're just getting real metaphysical now. They're so getting away from logic because it's... We reach limits of it. You know, we just don't know. And after I can't do anything about the universe, but I may do something about the earth. You know, I can't do anything about the past. I can teach about the past. I don't know what the future is going to be. Thank God I'm a historian. I don't have to predict the future. I let the social scientists do that. They're so good at it. So it's just, we can only take care of ourselves and try to figure out things the best we can. But if there's some general consensus on reality, it helps. We done?
This conversation is 400.
So we can carry on afterwards.
Mr. Gray.
Thank you.
Thank you.